We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse.
Greetings and welcome back to another exciting installment of the Fifth Column Podcast. This is your weekly rhetorical assault with the news cycle, the people that make it, and occasionally ourselves. I'm Camille Foster. I am so excited to be here. It is the week of our fifth anniversary.
Oh, look at fucking Truman.
I couldn't be more excited to be here with Michael Moynihan, Matt Welch,
Truman the dog,
who is the dog of the legendary Andrew Sullivan, who joins us for the third time, I believe, podcast for our fifth anniversary to discuss various things. This entire episode, I think we're going to devote to Sean P. Diddy Combs. Obviously, this is your home for all the latest updates on that incredibly fast-moving and developing legal situation. Free Diddy. Yeah, Free Diddy Central. We know he didn't do it.
We know
he's not guilty.
They got new video. Did you see that?
Right?
I told a story today, actually, on the phone with somebody. But I was having, I just mentioned our friend Jamie Kirchick. I was having lunch outside, out here in East Egg, with Jamie Kirchick and my dear friend Bob Colicello. And we're sitting outside, and Bob is, you know, in his 70s and stuff. And a guy walks by and stops and says, "Hey, Bob." And he starts talking to him. Bob is just like kind of looking at him. And he's like, "Yeah, okay, great. I'll talk to you soon." And the guy like was like alarmed and walked away. And I said, "Bob, were you doing that because you're mad at Russell Simmons?" Oh. And he's like, "Oh, that's who that was?" And I was like, no, he got canceled. And he clearly thinks that you don't want to talk to him.
Oh, no.
He's like, "Oh, wow. I'm so sorry." He just didn't register with him. But Russell Simmons stopped by the table. And I was like, "Oh, my God, Russell Simmons is here." But,
and he was just trying to figure it out.
Very, the whole very time? Canceled. He hasn't come back. So.
Yeah, I forgot what even happened with Russell Simmons.
He was accused of rape.
Like a capital R rape.
That is bad. Yeah. That is a bad thing.
Yeah. I asked him to sit down, but he just kept walking.
A wise man.
As you would.
I'm a wise man. I was like, tell me about the hip-hop movement.
Let's sit down with Moynihan. Let's see how that goes.
That's going to go. Yeah, I'm definitely not recording that.
Andrew, I was thinking this, and this is apropos of zero, but Joe Lieberman recently died. We talked about it last episode, but Camille was so stoned that all he could do was giggle, which is really inappropriate. But
that is not
that's
what happened. 100%
true.
That is not.
That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
No. But you were editor of the New Republic in the 90s. The New Republic was a weird publication in the 90s. Joe Lieberman was a weird politician in the 90s. And Moynihan was mentioning on the text thread that you are now officially a grumpy old man who goes to your neighborhood park to complain about the kids playing their rap music.
See what he writes in the Substack. He didn't tell me this. I just read it in the
Substack. Exactly. Yes. And Joe Lieberman was kind of that guy, too, in the 90s. I mean, he was really against video games, and he was sort of the Democratic wing of like, culture censorship that Hillary Clinton was as well. And I was just kind of curious, like, where was the New Republic's head at in those kind of 90s V-chip, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers are ruining the world
Matt,
culture wars then?
Those are very two distinct phenomena that you talked about. I'm not in favor of censoring anyone anywhere about anything, basically. The only issue I have is when people with amplifiers impose something upon other people who have no recourse but to leave. I think it's incredibly antisocial and ill-mannered and enraging. And I don't think that is anything like censorship. I think that's...
But Andrew, you do live in Provincetown in the summer, and I've been there, and it's really just a thumping, thudding beat everywhere you go.
Even in the world.
So you must kind of be used to it.
No, obviously you have certain habits where you go to places where thumping beats.
No, I don't know if you can hear it outside the dungeon, but from within the dungeon, it's very loud. Yeah.
You can't hear, this is the thing. This has happened recently in Provincetown in the famous tidal pools. I hate to bring us back there, but...
Never forget.
It's really always back to
worry, 5 minutes in. Yeah.
So there I am, resting peacefully, communing.
Yes.
That's what you call it. And the moon.
Yes.
Recall, Aaron.
And the guy that you met 20 minutes later.
The moon.
Yes. Yeah, that's what he calls himself. The moon.
The moon is pulling the tides. That's why the moon is connected.
It's beautiful.
Is that what's pulling the tides?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Anyway.
We are off to a splendid start.
Yeah. I go out there to be at peace, and these thumpy-thump-thump people with their Bluetooth boomboxes bring sound equipment. And once they brought a DJ and two 6-foot-high speakers that blasted. Now, when you're on the beach, actually in a bay, sound carries very far. This was horrible. This was horrible. But anyway, Joe Lieberman. I complained about it on a couple of occasions, but I've kind of just reconciled myself to the fact I can't do anything about this. I've had fantasies about maybe, you know, an EMP or some kind of Bluetooth jammer. some kind of water gun or something that would create a melee. And I have decided that it would be imprudent, actually, for me to throw myself into such a war, and I should just move. And
I mean, I have to say, I agree with Andrew on this. I think I might have told you guys, I played tennis once this year, one kind of warm day. And the people at the court next to me were playing, and about 20 minutes into playing, not from the beginning, but 20, they put a Bluetooth speaker at the net and just started playing really loud music. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? And it almost caused a problem because the person I was playing with was like, you can't. I'm like, no, of course you can. It was a very like Curb Your Enthusiasm moment, but I was like, you can't. I mean, it's not, I mean, I think Andrew would be okay if it was Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe music pumping out of those speakers. That would be the one exception that I think that would be okay.
Or Solange.
They themselves would say, no, please do not broadcast us in that place.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm on his side on this. But just
go watch they blast Lieberman. Steely
Dan. I'm pro being I'm considerate sorry to of others.
Distract us into the title, drag us into the title. We'll get, but the Lieberman question. Well, you know, Lieberman was, of course, Al Gore's running mate. And the Gore Lieberman ticket, in a way, was sort of the New Republic concentrated, distilled, marinated into a particular position. And so, yeah, I mean, the New Republic was obviously incredibly pro-Gore and loved Lieberman for all those reasons. I always found him pretty insufferable personally. I don't like the prudishness or prissiness of the guy. And as I said, after he died, I think this long tradition of liberal Zionism, which would constantly insist with a loud voice that they believe in a two-state solution and the Palestinians deserve the right to their own state. But at every particular moment when it might have made a difference, they didn't actually work for that. They're admirable, and in some ways, I really respected attachment to this refuge for the Jewish people. Meant that, in fact, they, I think, weren't tough enough on the Israelis, weren't clear enough in terms of what the long-term interests of the United States and of Israel were in trying to settle the Palestinian question.
Is there any, like, is that kind of liberal Zionism, does that even exist today in that sort of Marty Peretz, Joe Lieberman, New Republic way? I mean, it seems like all young liberals are, you know, as evidenced by the people pressuring Joe Biden from within the White House, the 25-year-olds who were protesting masked in front of their boss's house. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of that in this kind of Twitter world amongst young liberals.
It's all new Peter Beinart, not old Peter Beinart.
Yeah, and Peter is a fascinating example of a sort of a Brock-like switch. Because although I don't think he was ever as passionately pro-Israel as he is now passionately critical of Israel. This last few months where I'm thinking, well, I'm glad the New Republic isn't around. I'm still not editing it right now because it would have been a really tough story to cover. Partly because, obviously, that kind of very, very passionately pro-Israel, part of the Democratic Party. They're going through a very rough time right now, an extremely rough time. And in some ways, I think you see the Free Press, Barry, Jamie, or people like Douglas Murray, who've sort of upholding that tradition, the tablet in particular, Eli Lake, et cetera. So that's still there. And it's still there in the donor class, I think, to some to a great extent. But it feels like this is the moment when you can't anymore pull off, I'm a liberal and I will defend Israel to the nth degree, because it's just become really, really hard to do that.
You don't think John Fetterman is creating the new third way for that, of just saying they got attacked? They're still hostages. What's the problem?
The problem is that there's something called the laws of warfare. That's the problem. And now it is open question as to what has actually been happening. It's been incredibly hard to really figure it out. But no, it is not. Yeah. If you're attacked, you can do anything you want to the people who attacked you. That's not the laws of war.
But I don't think that's where even Fetterman or people who've been, I mean, there's been a few people who will go out there in Israeli politics who will say something like that. There was a little snippet of a quote from Douglas Murray assigning collective responsibility to everyone in Gaza, at least in a quip, if nothing else. But generally speaking, those that you just mentioned before, I don't hear them saying, there are no laws of war. I hear them saying there are, and Israel's trying and sometimes failing to live up to them. Meanwhile, they're in a difficult situation doing an urban war like Mosul or Raqqa.
Well, I was just responding that
in 2016
to the way you,
and 2017.
I was just responding to your assertion. I wasn't saying that was the only thing.
No.
Edelman is a bit like Mosul that. He just says, fuck you, they were attacked. He just hasn't really elaborated a grand theory of, he hasn't sort of dragged his Aquinas out and talked about international law.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that I like about him, which is just the fighting spirit of it all, of just walking out and giving people the finger as they're protesting him and like literally putting an Israeli flag on as a cape, which is just like, I just enjoy when people do things like that. But, to Matt's point, now, I mean, you talked about, Mosul or whatever you said, Fallujah. But I mean, now you have this sort of Abu Ghraib moment with this convoy. And, it could be, we don't know the details of it. This is people on the night shift at Abu Ghraib that essentially destroy or further damage America's reputation in the Middle East and really make everything difficult for the Bush administration at that point. I mean, you're seeing a similar version of that with this Jose Andres thing and the three cars, the thing that's so troubling about this is that there are three cars that are very far apart from each other. They're very separate. They're very well marked, and they were all hit individually. And it's surprising, because it gives a lot of fodder to these people that say this is the point. They're trying to destroy people that come in here and try to distribute aid because they don't want the Gazans to get aid. There doesn't make a ton of sense to me. And of course, the president of Israel, Herzog, and then you have Netanyahu and all these people coming out and offering their profuse apologies and realizing they have an enormous crisis on their hands. And they really, really do. I mean, you see somebody like the Daily Mail, which is, right-wing tabloid that is very pro-Israel, saying, a headline I saw this morning and I screenshot and sent to a friend of mine. It's, Israel is losing the world. I think that's actually kind of what it said. It's losing
the Economist
had relations that, battle, and the world is no longer on its side. And I don't think the world was really on its side before, but that is certainly true in this thing that happened a couple of days
ago. And American, American public opinion a week ago turned per Gallup. Like it went, the support for Israel and its actions against Gaza went from being positive to negative. And this is before the Jose Andres. Go ahead, Andrew. Sorry.
I think there was also the question of those images that you see of Gaza that are really look almost the same as Grozny. That's what it came to me, that they just destroyed a place. It is not that they've taken out people, but it looks like another planet. it looks as if they have dropped a nuclear bomb in the images that we see. And now I know all that is incredibly hard, and I just don't know enough, because I can't know enough. I don't trust enough of the sources that I'm seeing, the images that I'm seeing, to really understand what's happened. So I'm really leery of taking a position in the heat of war. But I have to say that the level of destruction, making it essentially uninhabitable for people, and that is partly inevitable, and it's not deliberate, but just the fact that population is so young in Gaza that you're going to disproportionately kill so many children in tackling Hamas, that has despicably insinuated itself among the sick, for God's sake, and children, for God's sake, in schools and hospitals. But there comes a point at which, I mean, I wrote a piece that said it's not genocide, but it is infanticide. And I don't mean that as a deliberate thing. It is literally, is probably the biggest murder of children. In how long? Just of how many children in such a short period of time have been killed in war?
I mean, that's obviously very hard to tell, particularly when you see these people, the statisticians who have done these kind of analyses of the figures from the Gaza Ministry of Health, and say, well, this doesn't make a ton of sense, and the numbers should be considerably lower. I mean, we're not going to probably ever know, and it's very hard to use those numbers now. But one of the things that I wonder about is, we see a kind of flip, particularly amongst people on the kind of hard left, who were very eager to attribute the responsibility for every death in Iraq to the Americans. You went in there, you started this, and everything that happens after that is your responsibility. So 100,000 people dead, 1 million dead, those are at the feet of the Americans. They don't seem to have the same sort of assignation of blame with Hamas, that this is, well, you started this, you could give up these hostages, you could negotiate, you're going to lose this war, there's no way you're going to win it, and they will keep at it until all of you are dead, time to come to the table, which they don't seem to not only want to do, but they seem to enjoy doing quite the opposite, because it makes the world come to their side in a way. I mean, who do you, do you put responsibility on their shoulders and the majority of it anyway?
When you talk about the Americans in Iraq, huge superpower going in, massive superiority, and then occupying. Hamas, absolutely militarily contemptible compared to, just pathetic compared to Israel. Goes a sort of 1 day, 2 day raid, and then retreats. That's a very different scenario in terms of the way you kind of look at it. And so the images in Gaza are not really the equivalent of Dresden, because the Palestinians aren't really the equivalent of an equal and opposite power that is genuinely putting the people of Israel at existential risk. So that...
I mean, they killed 1,000 people in a day. That's a lot. I mean, 1,000 people in a day.
Oh, it's horrifying. I'm not saying otherwise. I'm just saying, compared to the Blitz in London and the threat, it's just hard for people to think of those two as good analogies. They're not good analogies. They're far apart.
Mm-hmm.
There are some parts that are good. Yeah, there's some that are wrong.
Yeah. Clearly the political optics here from an international standpoint are very difficult for Israel and have only gotten more difficult in recent days as a result of this strike. The remarks out of the Biden administration have been pretty surprising, just like how critical they are. I think he referred to this conflict has been one of the worst in recent memories in terms of how many aid workers have been killed. And the aid organization itself explicitly referred to this as a targeted attack, insisted that they'd been coordinating with the Israelis with respect to the movement of their vehicles, and that essentially didn't even intimate, has explicitly alleged that they were targeted for the purposes of stopping aid. And there are reports now that they may be on the verge of famine there in Gaza with a lot of the aid work backed up. But relatedly, this is the same week where Israel has struck inside of Damascus and reportedly killed numerous Iranian officials, including a couple of top commanders. And that is having some repercussions as well. There have been plenty of suggestions that the United States already had a target on its back because of its staunch support of Israel. There are some speculation that things may be even worse now. How bleak a situation is this? At what point does this become completely untenable for the United States to maintain its current position? Are we already past that point? Is anyone willing to speculate on that?
I think that, you know, what they said about the targeting is clear. I mean, that's obviously true. I mean, but the implication of targeting, meaning, wait, it was deliberately targeting or there was some sort of cock-up.
That seemed to be the implication, that there was some deliberate targeting.
Yeah, that seems to be the most likely. Obviously, it wasn't a mistake. They were trying to hit these three vehicles. They did. Biden saying that this is the number of aid workers is wrong because he's relying on a UN number that includes both the West Bank and Gaza. And in those numbers, it actually explicitly says people who have died not in the theater of combat. So how does one disaggregate that? It's unclear. I mean, I don't know what that means. Not in the theater of combat. I mean, somebody slipped on a banana peel or something. But it's not the most solid number. I don't know why he's using it. As far as what's happening with Iran, I don't cry any tears for them because the Iranians since 1979, and more so recently, have been attacking Israel through their proxies. And, you know, I mean, they're setting off bombs in Argentina, blowing up Jewish centers and killing a couple hundred people there. I mean, they've been doing this in various places over. You can't just say, well, it wasn't us. I mean, we know it was you. And so when people start responding, one has to expect that. If you do this through proxies and attack Israel through Gaza, I mean, which is, you know, the Iranians have been funding Hamas and Hamas's military wing. And it's been doing so in Lebanon with Hezbollah. And you can expect people to sit back and say, well, let's just keep this going. Those are the people that are the money men. Those are the people that are the kind of brains behind these operations. And they're going to get hit. I mean, Trump did that with Soleimani, and it was expected to kick off World War III. It did not do that. And by the way, the Israelis have been hitting within Iran for a very long time now. I mean, if you're a nuclear scientist driving around Tehran, you probably have a pretty short lifespan, and you know that. That is just the way it goes. I mean, I think the timing of this with what's happened in the past couple of days alarms people, but it's not something that's totally surprising, particularly because Israel's been hitting, you know, munitions depots in Syria for the past like 3 or 4 months in airstrikes. And people haven't paid too much attention.
Months and years before that on occasion.
And months and years before
sporadically.
That.
And let's not forget that 60,000.
Blowing up the nuclear reactor and thing in Iraq. And,
I'm calling it
60,000 Israelis have evacuated from the north in their homes because of the rocket fire.
Because it's so hard to make sense in real time of what's actually happening on the ground. I think I see two things. One is that this attack was worse than 9/11. It was for Israelis. It was so psychologically disgusting, so barbaric, that it was seemed designed to touch part of the Jewish psyche in the most damaging, horrible way. It's an absolutely disgusting thing. But just as a matter of fact, that will create a response that is of much more impassioned and violent and angry and traumatized response from a people. And so you go to war knowing that. You go to war knowing that all every soldier is going to be feeling. And so this is precisely the war you have to be incredibly adamant about rules of conduct, about POWs, about civilians. This is incredibly frustrating. I'm not denying the unbelievable moral maze that Hamas has put Israel in, but unless Israel is in that, they respond immediately and emotionally, as is completely understandable. In that context, they are going to overshoot if they do not concentrate massively on restraining themselves. And that is what we have seen. And we've seen I mean, again, I don't know what we've seen really, because everything is distorted, but we can certainly see devastation that is truly shocking. We can just infer from the fact of what we know about the population that level of destruction will have disproportionately killed so many women and children. And we are also beginning to see these videos of IDF soldiers ridiculing, mocking Palestinians, joking about blowing up their mosques. Just some of the, it's horrible stuff. It's the kind of stuff that does happen in every war. But you shouldn't be seeing it on YouTube. I shouldn't be seeing, the IDF should be taking this stuff down immediately. None of that seems to be going on. So things are a bit out of control, like they were with Abu Ghraib, because from the very top, as with Abu Ghraib was nothing compared to Gitmo. Abu Ghraib was what they were doing all over the world, but just delegated, these people had no idea what the hell they were doing, just following the guidelines and moral positioning from the top. So my feeling is that there have almost undoubtedly been violations of the laws of war. It would be extraordinarily rare strange if that were not the case.
I mean, imagine if Iraq had TikTok and Instagram and every soldier had a phone. I mean, you have some of these really interesting documentaries that come where people have like handy cams, like Sony, and you can't actually, there's not a helmet cam. I mean, you have to hold it. You can't fight and film at the same time. You had to have somebody there with you. And so you have some, you know, footage that is pretty harrowing from Fallujah, but that always comes from people that were embedded with the troops, and the troops tend to behave a little differently if there's somebody embedded with them. But, you know, I mean, the restraint of, you see Israel trying to manage this in so many ways. Like, for instance, you know, they haven't gone into Rafah. And people, this has been a conversation that's been going on for a month now. And I think that there's a reason for that. I mean, I don't think it would be militarily too difficult for them to surround Rafah and just indiscriminately destroy it. But they haven't done so. And I think that's because of the Biden administration. I think that's because of internal pressure. And I think that war cabinet that, you know, makes up Netanyahu's war cabinet, which has some crazy people in it and some, you know, Benny Gantz type people who are sort of more moderate and centrist, are holding back on things like that. So I think they're very conscious of, and I'm sure that those troops doing things like posting videos of, you know, putting people's underwear on and things like that, I'm sure they're being sanctioned for that. I doubt that they, because I mean, obviously anyone in a war situation doesn't want their troops to get out of hand. I mean, for a variety of reasons.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in Andrew's formulation of, you know, that when you go to war, this is where the passion is going to be. There's been some really good reporting the last couple of days, not just in Haaretz, but also in the Times of Israel. And Barak Ravid has also done some talking about some of the rules of engagement problems that are on the ground, which in certain places are like, is it military aged? We're shooting. I wouldn't fight in that war. I'm scared. I'm old and scared. I wouldn't fight if I was 21. Maybe if it was like my own country, I would look at it differently. So I'm not saying that I'm Mr. Brave Guy or anything like that. But it's clear that the rules of engagement have been degraded. And this is obviously leading to some of the problems and the atrocities. It's going to be atrocious. It is urban war. The enemy in this case, Hamas, chose to fight in an urban setting and to hide behind civilians and to tunnel behind everything and hold hostages. They made the choice of that war, and it is awful. And it's going to be awful to prosecute that war no matter what. But there's something, there's some wisdom in what Andrew points out, which is that of course, there's going to be a disproportionate reaction in the world, as there generally has been towards Israel over the years, but also just, you know, that's a David Goliath story. It seems like, at least by not October 8th or 9th, but by November or December or whatever, you start to notice there's just disproportionality that always comes in to the question here. And so Israel is absolutely right to point out that they're held to standards that no one is. And the question is, what do you do in that? You can, while you're grieving and while you're hurt, you can say, fuck all y'all, which is a very understandable response. And there's quite a few people, I'm sure, who have done that. And you can also say, it is a privilege to be held to this high standard. It is a privilege to be held to a standard that no country around Israel is going to be held to, because that is a marker that people expect us to be part of civilization, and to wrap your strategy, wrap your ideas around that notion. It is a burden. It's a terrible burden. Civilization is also a burden, and it's something that I'm not sure exactly, you know, we can't know. Andrew's also right about that. Like, we really can't know what the hell's going on. Can't even know if there's a famine. I mean, a lot of people say there's a famine. Seems like there should be. There's a lot of pictures of famine. There's also hundreds of aid trucks that go in. And also, to the point of visibility, you know, it might be true. It seems plausible that when Biden says that we haven't seen so many aid workers get killed, journalists get killed as well. Also, in places where we've seen that kind of urban warfare, it hasn't been a place where there's been a whole lot of aid workers and Jose Andres trucks and journalists congregated. They weren't hanging out in Mosul in 2016, right? That's just not what the dynamic was. So that's also, I think, affecting our view of things. And it's a damnable situation. I don't know how you, in the words of our great friend Kennedy, how you unfuck the cat. You can't unfuck the cat in terms of the situation that you've been given. They still hold hostages. They've chose urban warfare. It fucking sucks on every level. But also, you know, this is not going to be a war that's going to be fought 7 months from now, I don't think. We've had, what, 5-6 months so far. There's basically one last little geographical redoubt. It's an important one. But I think we tell ourselves this exact conflict is going to be the one that's going to be dominating everybody's consciousness. I wonder, and this is total conjecture, I wonder if the Biden administration, Biden himself, has a sense of, I need to be condemning this at all times, and I also want to be telling them, hurry up and finish, right? Get it out of the way so it's no longer a thing. Because he doesn't, I don't think, really have, or I don't know who has, a plan B for the thing that's happening right now. Because you have to get those hostages back, and at every step, Hamas is not doing it.
There was one aspect of this war that we do know. If we don't know what happens on the ground, we do know. And when I was trying to figure some of this stuff out a few weeks ago, I was like, well, what does it take to take Fallujah? What do you have to do? That's a similar situation. I mean, completely similar, but roughly similar. You're going to kill a lot of people. Or the Iraq in general, they're doing that. And I discovered, you know, one fact is that the evacuation of these cities of civilians was done before the West attacked them in the way that Israel did. Israel did not evacuate all the civilians. In fact, it's very unclear whether they even gave them directions. And one of the terrifying parts of this is they did direct them to safe places, which turned out not to be safe. Now, I don't know what's going on, but here's one statistic that really troubled me. In the entire war in Iraq, the entire war for years, the West dropped one 2,000-pound bomb. The Israelis, March, had dropped on that tiny little square 500 2,000-pound bombs. Now, I don't know how you do that in a densely packed area without knowing very well that you are massive. Thousands of innocents.
I haven't heard I wonder if it's something to do with the fact that I'm not doubting it, but I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that almost all of the Hamas fighters are underground.
That might have something to do with it. That might have.
Hamas
has made this horrifying. They put Israel in this horrifying position, but they have gone through with it, and it's, you know, Machiavelli's. Machiavelli would say, go through with it all the way. The worst thing you could do is sort of not finish it off. Then you really.
I mean, and I think that's probably true in this case. I mean, it's a matter of how you execute
that. But it was not
that.
Paul but, saying it, not Thomas. You know, it's, that's my
point. Yeah.
And, you know, I think there are a lot of people. And my concern is this. Had Israel, if this turns out to be, and we don't know, again, And I understand why they felt they had to do this. And I get that. I really do. I'm not trying to be. And it's just, we're in this horrible situation, right? But if Israel turns out to have committed, and objectively, like, really awful stuff, will Israel really be able to be defended as a Western country for much longer? Because it's going to become an increasingly theocratic, and increasingly right-wing, and increasingly polarized against the neighbors, it seems.
I mean, the opposite of that could also be true,
yeah,
in the sense that, you know, Netanyahu's under intense pressure, and all of the polling suggests that if there was an election today, that he would be booted out of office. I mean, recalling that prior to this war, I mean, he was under indictment, mm-hmm, too. I mean, there's a lot of people that were gunning for him. I mean, the country was in tumult, and I'm sure that that was possibly why Hamas attacked when it did, because of the judicial stuff, between the Supreme Court stuff, which was tearing the country apart. I mean, people from all sides of the spectrum were on the streets of Tel Aviv every night doing this. I mean, but
and they've been, you know, there the this week too. Let's not forget.
Yeah, and this week too, there's been a lot of people protesting in front of his house and things, mm-hmm, like that. But one of the things that, you know, you realize was funny back in the Iraq days, the number of people, myself too, I mean, I was totally guilty of this, that you'd look at Germany and you'd look at Japan and say, well, these are analogs, which they weren't at all. And one of the things that people didn't realize, that Vietnam is kind of the start of this, it's about a half start of this, but since Vietnam, America never fights militaries that wear uniforms, which is very, very difficult. Fighting Germans was quite easy, Japanese quite easy, when you see people who are in uniforms with, you know, regulation guns that their country gives to them. They're very easy to spot. They have tanks that are easy to spot, et cetera. And, I mean, you're essentially fighting somebody who's like, it's a boxing match, and then they turn out the lights, you know, and say, go at it. It's like, well, where? Who? And it makes things very difficult, obviously. I mean, if you were fighting a fighting force that had, you know, uniforms, had divisions, had army commanders in the traditional way, I think this would be a rather different result.
But you don't do that anymore. Doing this agonizing, painstaking, incredibly frustrating task of trying to confront this terrorism with the weapons they use. So my point was simply that after all that effort, I think what happened on October 7th was they said, fuck it. You can feel that. Fuck it. We're just going to fucking teach them a lesson.
Yeah, and I think that probably one of the ideas too is hold out as long as you can. Have as many people of your own people, quote unquote, because I don't think they really even think of it like that, killed, and you watch the opinion turn, and you say, as you know, Andrew just said, I mean, can Israel even be a country that has allies after this? And I think that's kind of the goal, in a way. There was an interview with one of these Hamas guys at the beginning of the war, and it was a tough question from somebody from Al Jazeera or Egyptian channel, and they said, well, why don't you build bomb shelters? Israel, you look at a you know, Israeli map on you know, Google Maps, in every corner there's a bomb shelter indicated that you can you know, jump into if a Hamas rocket is coming. There's none in Gaza. There's stuff underground, but it's not for the ordinary person. And this person has asked that, you assume they're going to say, well, no, we have that, but the infrastructure is not. He just said, well, that's not our responsibility. That would be the UN's responsibility. It's not our responsibility. I mean, that's a tactic, mm-hmm, to make sure that people don't have a place to go. And you see that this is happening right now, and they seem to relish this in a way.
But isn't it?
You know, it's
kind of
it's
working.
Propaganda for them.
Isn't
that? Of course, it absolutely.
We've always absolutely worried about this, like ratcheting up and up and up. And the other thing that has been clear is that the United States has incredibly limited say over what Israel does. And so there are almost, and yet the aid is unconditional, always unconditional. So it's very hard to think of any other relationship with another country similar to that. And I think that I'm talking now about Hamas succeeding in a way, is that Hamas has also gotten Israel to fuck up its American relationship. very successfully. And, you know, it's an interesting question as to what Trump would do on this, because, you know, likely the next president, he's hovering over this. And, you know, I don't know. Really don't. The part of me thinks, well, if you look at what they did in the first Trump term, it was just, let's build as many West Bank settlements. Let's starve and deprive as many Palestinians as we can. Let's give them everything they want and more. But I think there's a point at which someone like Trump's like, well, this, they're not doing very well here, are they? Why are we getting dragged down with this shit? And Cuddle?
Well, he said that the other day, right? To some visiting Israel. He said, you know, you guys got to wrap this up.
That's
a very Trump thing to say. it's like, oh, okay, let's just wrap it up. Sorry.
That's his view about Ukraine, too.
I want to talk about Trump specifically, but you mentioned Ukraine, Andrew, and since you guys were talking about some different parallels historically, I'm curious what you make of the broader international conflict scene where the United States is involved. The Ukraine situation is still ongoing. They lowered their draft age recently, which is perhaps an indication that they're under tremendous pressure, obviously. But striking a bit deeper in Russia with drones this week.
Very deep in Russia.
So that's you know, a pretty substantial deal. But similarly, the Chinese and the Americans are talking again. Biden and Xi had a phone call this week, and it went so well that the Chinese dispatched something like 30 planes to fly around and set Taiwan on edge. I mean, this is a pretty extraordinary international situation for the United States to be managing. Essentially, every single one of their major political rivals is engaged in some sort of either active proxy conflict with Iran and Russia or with the Chinese. It's more than simmering at this point. Can you remember a time prior to this where it's been this contentious in this many places? And I'm not even mentioning the insane things that are happening just off of our shore in Haiti or the crazy border situation on the southern border. Like, there's just a tremendous amount of international tumult, and the United States find itself engaged in a lot of these things pretty directly.
You're so young, Camille. You're so young.
You don't remember the Cold War.
Dude, Cold War was like 1,000 of these all the time. Yeah. That's all that happened. We were like, half of the Reagan
all I remember is the 90s.
About Contras.
Everything was fine.
Then, Camille, you'd be like, you could just see what's happening in Nicaragua, in Cuba, in El Salvador.
Yeah, South Africa, Angola. Yeah. Like, the list was fucking long. And the amount of freedom in those places was a hell of a lot less than it is now. We've had a bad 8 or 9 years globally speaking, but the end of the Cold War unleashed a whole lot of freedom and prosperity comparative when the superpowers were no longer proxy warring and sometimes war warring, as in Korea, openly. It's a lot better. What? It sucks right now. It's gotten worse.
If I kick this to Andrew, and I want to put another little spin on this to wonder, you know, we had the neocon moment in 2000, 2008, and George W. Bush 2001, 2009. In that, you know, America should be more involved in the world. I mean, this is the Team B comes back to life. And, you know, we see what happens, right? I mean, that said, I mean, George W. Bush didn't run on that platform. He was actually running on a smaller international footprint in 2000. People tend to forget
that.
But, you know, we did.
Levers that the West has pulled have not worked. Yeah. For example, Russia sanctions stuff, the economic sanctions model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you remember, was going to be, the word used was crippling. That we are going to
never been crippled.
Put such a constraint on an economy like we're about to with Russia.
Yeah.
And Russia grows greater in that period than Western Europe and is busy constructing trade and arms deals with the Chinese and the Indians and is reorganizing its economy around that.
North Koreans.
So you have China and Russia kind of in league. You haven't managed to prevent Russia. You haven't crippled Russia's economy at all. You are now in a stalemate in Ukraine with Russia having the advantage. You have Israel going rogue and losing its, putting in jeopardy its relationship with the United States. This is a collapse of various very usual conventional blob techniques with foreign policy, it seems to me. And it suggests that we're in a new world.
But isn't, I guess the question I have for you is, I think that what you're saying is kind of what I was getting at, is that, you know, after 2009, I mean, you have the Obama foreign policy, and then you have the Trump foreign policy. And, you know, the Biden one has been confused in a lot of ways, but it was, you know, America retreating from the world. That was the idea. We were not going to be as active as we were in the past. And it would be things like sanctions. That's what we could do. But despite that, and I'm not saying in any way that the better option is to re-engage in the world in an aggressive way, but the other option hasn't really brought much peace. When you see, you know, Syria in 2014 and the civil war there, and Russia getting involved and, you know, bombing everything for years and destroying hospitals and destroying, I mean, absolute calamity that people just don't even remember, despite the fact the United Nations says 500,000 people died. You know, Russia invading Georgia, taking, you know, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, then taking Ukraine. I mean, has America retreating been, you know, great for the world in that way?
That sort of the question of whether America could retain permanently its 20th century position, especially after the end of the Cold War, it strikes me that that was very unlikely. And so that process of decoupling from that in the 21st century was going to happen in some way. And then the utopian idea that China's going to be part of this great globalized free trade area and we'll all be happy Democrats, that's also obviously collapsed. But we forget how many people thought that was going to happen. And I think that Trump and the Republicans are classically returning to the classical Republican position in foreign policy, which is, you know, we're in America. Let's not fuck it up. Why do we have to be involved in this shit? And we do have to control it, but when we don't, we don't want to control every part of it. We don't want to dominate every single sector of it. We don't want to be the unipower. So that's what we're seeing.
Should the United States have given anything to the Ukrainians? Any weapons?
Honestly, it's a very hard thing to do. Yes, of course, we would kind of have to, I think, and the Europeans should have too. But at some point, there has to be realistic deployment of those forces, which is you're not going to, as you know, my friends, my well-intentioned pro-Ukraine friends told me last spring that this was going to be the summer offensive in which Russia was finally defeated and let's give it one heave-ho. No, that was never going to happen. So we need some deft diplomacy to kind of sort that out. I personally, and this could be, I really don't see in the grand scheme of things how it is in the United States' interest to prevent Taiwan, this tiny island, thousands of miles away, right next to China, completely ethnic Chinese. I just don't see how the logic of where we are now could lead to the defense of Taiwan. Because I just don't think it will. And I think in some ways we're having some, I think because we don't really have the capacity to deliver on some of the things that we seem to be holding ourselves responsible for, I think we're in a pretty bad spot right now.
Should anyone defend Taiwan? Regionally, should Australia get involved? Whoa. Japan? Should we just leave
China?
It to its
own it was devices? Always. I mean, it's less complicated than Northern Ireland. You know, it's only a very recent phenomenon. This thing, and I'm just saying, it is a small island, thousands of miles. Do you really think the United States could be the protector of that island? What is I understand the microchip argument, which I wish had been pointed out to me a few years ago, but obviously I should have figured it out a few years ago first. But nonetheless, obviously that does change the equation. If we can't, but we're obviously trying to do that. We're trying to replicate some of that chip capacity in the United States. I just think if you looked at this from Bismarck's point of view or from Metternich's point of view, you'd be like, we're gonna expend our entire international credibility on defending this tiny island that was always a part of this country.
We're on imperial autopilot, and a lot of the structures that were created after World War II made all the sense in the world and also had a strong support from American public opinion, which is always important and underrated in these things. In the prosecution of the Cold War, we were the leader of the freed world. It made sense. America's unipower thing at the end of the Cold War, post-Cold War, only sporadically and usually not has had that similar type of undergirding in public opinion, but these structures still exist. And all of those structures are vulnerable to populist attack and critique and demagoguery as well. I think you're right, Andrew. I don't want to admit that you're right, but I think that Taiwan is an inevitability. And part of the problem with that is that I don't think that there has been, aside from like the problem of, my God, the Taiwanese, this will be a horrible, horrible thing that happens. And it'll happen probably in our lifetimes, and it sucks. That the U.S. hasn't consciously addressed what comes after imperial autopilot, right? NATO could have been transferred into a European structure, a European-led structure. It wasn't, mostly because Europeans suck, as you know. but also because we haven't been consciously figuring out how to do that.
That was a very Chomsky thing just to say, as you know, of course.
obviously, done the research. but also true, like to Moynihan's question, like the answer to every question of who's going to defend fill in the blank has been America forever in places like in the South China Sea. Why is that the obvious answer? It's no longer supported by American public. It's not even connected to American public opinion. So the people whose business it is to think about and to activate government should have been working on the project. Maybe like at the end of the neocon era would be a good time for that project to have been worked on, which it really was not, of what comes next. It's easy just to say those guys suck. They were wrong. Fuck them. And meanwhile, what have you created? And also, what are the structures that are going to last? I mean, there's one of the sections about the Israel argument in America, which I find kind of almost comedic, is that suddenly you have the Bernie Sanderses of the world saying, why can't we tell Israel what to do? Like, wait, aren't you in the camp that gets mad when America like tells people who their government should be, like Chuck Schumer did on the Senate floor a month ago?
Only if it's Nicaragua, speaking of Nicaragua.
I mean,
that was the time you got mad about
one, one of the things that happens when America has fewer levers to pull is that in a sense, that's good, right? Like it is an acknowledgement of where we are going regardless. It's not necessarily going to be good for the individual countries or people involved, but it's a acceptance of a certain reality of things. But when that happens, for instance, in the Israel relationship, if we were to somehow cut off military aid, which we can't actually really do until 2028 or something, how do you think that's going to change the way Israel's going to go shopping? Israel has money. They can buy arms from other people. That our military aid to Israel is contingent on them buying 75% of their stuff from us. It might look a little bit different. People who are less contingent on American aid. I mean, we use that aid to try to influence Qatar. We try to influence Egypt and Saudi Arabia. We have all these levers that we think that we're pulling, but they have much, much less power and leverage anymore, part of which is a good thing. But I don't think that we've been thinking about it, and we're just sort of blustering our way through critiquing whoever the current president is from the opposition party, saying, well, he blew it. I'm going to do that thing better, rather than sort of conceptualize what a new kind of international settlement would be.
Well, can we talk about the next president? Because Andrew just said that he was pretty sure that the next president
Well, I
was going to be his hero. And the person
who talks out loud about foreign policy that is asking the most naive questions, what are we over there? What the hell are we doing? What is it money for? Is him. And if you underestimate the resonance of that when everybody else is talking about acronyms and our role here and there, with the memory of Iraq very fresh in people's minds. I mean, maybe it's dimming a little bit, but you know, and one worries that Israel, that what's happening with Gaza just reiterates the image of the West of Abu Ghraib and of Iraq. And I mean, that for me was the turning point. I realized after that there was no way the United States could reclaim really without serious problems the moral high ground. And clearly it couldn't claim that it had matters to protect stability or the world order in that. That was it for me. If that failed, and it did fail, then the logic of history was that it would take a lot for America to remain the imperial power indefinitely, but that made it much less likely to carry on indefinitely. It took the wind out of the sails of everyone, including me, who thought of the United States in a certain fashion. And slowly the attitudes that era gave us, which was, you know, this concern for parts of the world that were very alien to most people. I mean, I remember writing stories about, you know, the struggle for democracy in Burma and in Thailand, and these were important to me. Why should they be important very much to an American at some base level? I mean, at least...
Now you're just concerned about the music that's being played in your local park. That's where your focus is now.
I mean,
not the poor people of Burma. Fuck them. They probably have very good laws against public nuisance.
Is this giving me permission to? I got high for this, and then we went into war crimes.
That was not the plan. We ended up.
Well,
there
let me change the subject. I'm going to change the subject for you. Okay. And here's how I'm going to change the subject.
Well, here's I know
that you love dead children. We're just gonna forget about that. Yeah. We're just gonna pretend that you don't like love when people get tortured in authoritarian countries. But I can give you a segue into. I want to talk about the piece that we were talking about. The three of us were talking about earlier, the piece that you wrote on Substack about Trump. But, you know, it's funny, the American thing, that moment after Iraq had failed and everything had to change, that happened because of America, because of American institutions, because of American democracy. That's not happening in Russia right now, which Russia has failed. I mean, this is a failure. We cannot, I mean, people who think that Russia has won or is winning this war is not looking at the fact that maybe 100,000 Russians have died. When 3,000 Americans died in Iraq, I mean, 100,000 Russians with, you know, a third of the population, I think, or, you know, maybe a little less than that. And, you know, I mean, it destroyed the Soviet Union when 16,000 people died in Afghanistan. And you have an enormous number, and they're not holding any territory. It's been, you know, it's World War I. It's a matter of inches and a matter of miles. So it hasn't done that in Russia, but did it to us. It did it to us because... we are a great country and a democratic country, and we can have these conversations. But those institutions lead me to the question about your piece about Donald Trump. I had a conversation with a friend recently who I think we all know here, but well, remain nameless because it was a private email correspondence. And I was like, look, I don't think that if Donald Trump wins, it's the end of democracy. I don't worry about that in the way that you do. And he enumerated his concerns, and he's a kind of a conservative guy, and he hates Donald Trump, and he says, this is what's going to happen. The last time was a bunch of bozos. This time it's going to be much more sinister. He's figured certain things out. You wrote a piece that said, well, I wrote that back in the day and thought Donald Trump was going to destroy everything. Maybe that didn't happen. Where are you on this now? I mean, you think that when people say democracy is under threat, I mean, good Lord, if he wins, it's all over. You say no.
I don't think that. I mean, look, to some extent, you had an unknown. And he was saying things that were incredibly dangerous. And he still is, for that matter. But we had a test. 4 years. And we also had, he was given this also this golden opportunity that every wannabe authoritarian would love, a health crisis, an epidemic. That is like, COVID, yeah. That's dictators long for that power. And he didn't take it. He is in every respect tyrannical by his nature. He is incapable of understanding non-zero-sum interactions, so he is incredibly bad for our system of government. He is corroding by the very zero-sum language that he uses. He has curdled this country and will continue to curdle it in such a fashion that the left is going to get even crazier, the right even crazier, because he cannot ever bridge anything. That he doesn't have to be someone who uses the forces of state power to control people's lives to fuck the American Republic. Not only that, because he is absolutely opposed to the rule of law if it comes to anything concerning him, he's elevating the presidency again, will be an affirmation by the American people that the rule of law no longer matters. Really. Or that the rule of law is really a plot by the deep state or whatever else, that he will go anywhere to defend those things. So that's why he remains a threat to liberal democracy. That was the point I made. Not democracy, it was liberal democracy. Because you can have authoritarian democracy. You can have polarized tribal racial identity warfare, which is where we're headed, which he will intensify and accelerate. I fear, maybe not. I mean, who knows? But
he will intensify and accelerate it how? By directly engaging in those conflicts, or by inspiring people to take the battles more seriously?
By driving the left become crazier, a bit more hysterical. By removing any space for any conversation in the public sphere, because he polarizes so dramatically around the gut issues that really do divide us. And he makes it impossible for there to be, because of the way he polarizes the discourse, he makes it impossible for liberal democracy to work, because you can't possibly get a coalition under those circumstances. You can't. Because no one would say one another, there's no, and you still have two parties that are big enough to counteract each other, which is a recipe for civil unrest, serious civil unrest. So I don't want people to take from that article, I have no worries about Donald Trump becoming president again. I do. I do not have a worry that he's going to turn into Pinochet. I do not have a worry that he's going to send the troops onto the streets. He had every opportunity to do that before, and he didn't. Now, will he be a different person next time? No, he won't. He. We know this from him. He's incapable of changing. He will fuck them over, all those Claire monsters and all the people coming in with Project 2025. And they'll all be earnest. And he will, after one fucking lunch, would throw a remark off that will destroy everything that they've done. He's a force of destruction, not construction.
So what were you wrong about when you wrote that initial piece that you revisited? And I know that you talk about this in the piece, but for our listeners who haven't read it, I mean, you should go to Andrew's Substack and subscribe. But if you haven't read it, what do you think that you got wrong, or you were maybe too worried about?
Tell
maybe
the Supreme Court wrong, to go fuck right itself. And that he would violate whatever they said. That he would ignore other branches of government entirely. Or that he might resort to the military. Now, we have him talking about this. We know he talked about it while he was in office. And then we saw after, before January 6th, in that period, he's capable of anything in his own defense, out of his own ego.
What about January 6th? I mean, the response, if I ever have this conversation, it's within seconds that somebody deploys January 6th. I mean, do you think that was a slow motion coup that January 6th? I mean, do you think that was a coup? No. It was, him obviously trying to do an end run around what the voters wanted, right?
It was all those things, motivated by all those foul motives, and at the same time, a farce. That's what's so strange about this, you know? It's the language and the logic and the arguments of all of it are incredibly authoritarian, but the actual, and dangerous and anti-democratic and all the rest of it. But it turns out, you know, they don't actually get to do that. They're not interested in governing, put it that way. It's not about, I'm worried about someone getting power and being dictator and controlling our lives. And he doesn't do that. He renders liberal democracy impossible, and therefore maybe in the increasing, if he gets crazier and crazier in a second term, we could end up with some kind of unknowable constitutional crisis or violence on the streets. I think we might, with the legitimacy of this coming election, because he's going to call it illegitimate if he loses.
I mean, he called it illegitimate when he won.
Yeah. He's already floating
that. But he also said in advance, if he lost, he would say it was illegitimate. I mean, this is a man who said, I don't believe in this system at all. I will not even, you know, I will even vow to abide by the results of the vote. I mean,
I interviewed Steve Bannon in October 2020, and he told me that it doesn't matter what happens, he's going to say that he won. Yeah. And he's like, I know that for a fact. He's just going to say that. It was planned.
But Michael, I said, not to blow my mind, I said 4 years before that, he will never concede an election. He will never concede. It is impossible. He's psychologically incapable. He's just awful.
Well, make the argument for against Joe Biden in the sense that, like, well, the other option is somebody who will concede, the somebody who won't put us in the position of a constitutional crisis, of somebody who will not say any of these crazy things. What would you say to the people, the, you know, 65 million people who voted for Trump or planning on voting for him next time, that's the better option? Or do you even think it's the better
Biden
option?
Is the better option?
Yeah.
Look, all I know is you don't elect someone as crazy as Donald Trump, as toxic as Donald Trump, and as, I mean, what I just described of a psychological inability to play the game of democracy fairly, incapable of playing any, having any non-zero-sum interaction, that's a mental illness. We're electing someone incapable of being president in a liberal democracy. What? I mean, it's a mental illness.
I think that's probably right.
I think it's so psychologically fucked up. He's making decisions based on nothing of the evidence around them relevant to the actual decision making. Now, you can elect a crazy person like that if you want. I don't. I think it's insane to do so. But do I worry that Biden, in some ways, in the way that he wants to control us, is more authoritarian? Are there aspects of the left that are now more authoritarian? Go to fucking Scotland, where it is now legal, if someone at home in their own domicile is of the view and expresses this to maybe a rebellious child, teenager, who may be going through a phase or whatever, that they don't actually think a trans man is in every respect a man, that teenager can now call the police on his father as of today, as of April 1. As a
man, now, I would have Scottish police ringing my house. I mean, that's great, Michael. Come out. What you say house. Last night? That was really bad, actually.
You see some of these. Of course, in reality, like what happened this last week is that J.K. Rowling got up in the morning in Scotland, where she lives, and tweeted out that she doesn't believe that a trans man is a man or a trans woman a woman, and the police in Scotland refused to prosecute her. So she, on the other hand, there were already apparently 30,000 referrals to people for being bigots. Instantly.
Really?
Yeah. Instantly, people took this opportunity to get the cops on that person they fucking hate and remember a conversation they had with that person where they said something or other that was offensive or was, you know, could be insulting to a particular group, and we're off to the races.
Yeah. Ross Douthat had a great piece about this in the Times today, and essentially made the case that he had no expectation that Rowling would get in trouble. But of course, there are plenty of regular people, lower profiles, who are substantially at risk of being prosecuted under laws like this. And I think you're correct to make a connection between the proclivity towards illiberalism on the left and the right, but to make a connection between what we've seen domestically amongst progressives and this kind of overreach, a liberal overreach in various European contexts. But I wanted to highlight one other thing that was in this piece that you wrote and ask you about it, Andrew. Specifically, there's a section in there where you talk about the looters and the insanity of 2020 and the fact that Donald Trump didn't perhaps go as far as he could have in pushing back against that. That would have been an opportune
chance. Camille, but Tom Cotton did write an editorial. Yes. Let's be very clear about the country we were living in.
Yeah. Well, that would have been a great chance for him to, you know, call in the military and exercise all sorts of authority. And he didn't do it, although he made noises about it. But what I find really interesting is I saw a headline earlier this week, I think it was a New York Mag, Democratic donors, Republican donors no longer care about the insurrection. So they're happy to give their money to Donald Trump is ostensibly the argument there. And it seems to me that there's still today, like, precious little recognition of just how insane things were during the summer. Like the buildings that were, the federal buildings that were under siege for multiple days at a time, the White House being surrounded, and people who've listened to this podcast have certainly heard me opine about this before. And I think it would probably be fair to say that the Democratic donor class, like, not only did they not really care about what happened in 2020, at least rhetorically, I don't hear anyone ever talk about that. I'm not even sure that most of them acknowledge that this is a thing that happened and that during that period, everyone was using the most disturbing and disgraceful euphemism to cover up what was happening. They were setting up bail funds for protesters and demonstrators and, quite frankly, rioters as well, at exactly the same time that police departments and other municipal buildings were being burned to the ground and people were being murdered and otherwise injured behind these protests. And the durable effects of all of this is the further unraveling of our polity. But even more than that, it helped to precipitate a tremendous increase in unrest of other kinds. Like, we did see a spike in violent crime. We did see a spike in other kinds of crime. And in general, policing took a pretty major hit as a result of all of this. So I'm curious about what you think about the potential for dysfunction on the left domestically and whether or not we take that threat seriously.
Well, when I look at, I read the articles about why we should be terrified of Trump, and you go in there and they say they have this army that's seeking to dismantle the administrative state. And I'm like, that doesn't sound terribly authoritarian to me. They'll destroy everything. They'll fuck everything up. But I don't think it's a performance. It's a conservatism for talk radio, not for governing. And the left governs, and we've seen that when they do govern and have power, they have no truck with fucking with individual rights, with shutting people up, with firing them for the wrong views, with using race and sex and other things as a way to discriminate against certain people. It is, in some ways, when you look at the sort of genuinely, and this is, you know, totalitarian is too much, but it's not authoritarian in the sense that it really is attempting to control people's thoughts, their language, their minds. And that also is part of the censorship complex that they have. It is not true that this crazy ass is the only threat to democracy right now. Mm-hmm. It is not true. And in fact, when you look at where the power really is, it's not on the right, I don't think, in vast sections of the society that we live in. And
Culturally, anyway.
Well, right? You know, we do have a Democratic president. Culturally, yeah, things like corporations think are actually right with you. No, they are the instruments of indoctrination at this point. They are the they propagandize. I mean, I can't go to the gym without having, you know, Women's History Day, and I mean everything is just it's propaganda of this stuff is in social. People are.
What
you know what's going good to bring?
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't think they did that at that gym.
Asian American month at the gym. It's like what are you?
Yeah, I thought it was just always Pride Month at your gym. Yeah, like every month.
I mean, this. I mean, I'm obviously over egged and splitting, but I because I'm subjected to all this stuff all the time. I at this point would love, and I say this because I have I'm always for transgender rights. I have friends. I believe the transgender people should be defended, and et cetera, et cetera. I do all. I believe all that passionately. Always have, always supported. Way back when, and of course, I'm now this disgusting transphobe because I'm like, I don't think we should maybe pretend biology doesn't exist, and maybe children shouldn't be making lifelong decisions. That's all I'm saying. But
why did that happen to the trans movement, by the way? I mean, as somebody who was like, you know, instrumental in the gay rights movement, writing early books about gay marriage, and that never didn't seem to really take hold amongst the gay rights movement, who was just like, okay, we have to be kind of, you know, acceptable to everybody. We have to make sure that mainstream America kind of gets that we deserve to have partners, we deserve to have, marriage, we deserve to have all the civil rights that you have. And it was a mainstreaming. This seems to be quite the opposite of that.
The fact
how did that happen?
That we won. What else are we going to do? I mean, so I gave a talk in like 1990 to the Human Rights Campaign where I said the goal of every civil rights movement should be to shut itself down. Yeah. We don't want to be busying people into being tolerant all the time. We don't. It's not. We want to have equality and freedom and dignity, and we can change the culture the way we want. But no. And so we got marriage in the military. I said in advance, well, if we did that, we was done. At the most, civil rights protections and employment and all the rest of it. But after that, what else is there? There's nothing. We're done. So we left. This isn't the same movement. It's the remnants of that movement, which has then been marinated in queer theory, critical queer theory, critical gender theory. They have been taught a history that is a bunch of lies about gay people. Don't get me started.
Is it a homophobic movement? I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that.
It is a very simple point. If there are not two sexes, it is impossible to be a homosexual. The whole point is that I'm attracted to one and not the other. And the current definition of being gay, of these gay groups, is now having sex with someone with a vagina, is being gay. They have integrated heterosexual sex into homosexual identity. They've abolished.
Wait, so I'm gay? Is that true?
Yeah.
Been saying it.
We've been telling you for years.
It's about, trans men, obviously. It's about, you know, the International Mr. Leather Contest had a workshop on vaginas. Because can you imagine?
Yeah.
Now,
I'm sorry.
You know, when I saw Toms of Finland, I'm like, there's just not enough women in this. That's
what here's the thing. I mean, there is this strange church of the extreme. As I said, the last person that told me I needed to have a workshop with a vagina was a priest.
Queers. Yeah. And then when he found out that you didn't want that, he was like, awesome. Come to my house.
You see how weird that is?
If you actually think being gay
means having sex with another biological male, you're not just being gay. You have genital prejudice. You're a bigot. You're a transphobe. All this other stuff. You should look at the homophobia directed at gay people for not wanting to have sex with people who have vaginas. This is not the spirit of the gay rights movement. This is a very different alien spirit. It is not about, I mean, the last thing the gay rights movement was about constraining speech. We depended on it. The only right we had. One magazine, that fantastic little magazine, Mattachine Society, put out in the 1950s. I mean, that was revolutionary. And now they want to tell other people they can't write stuff and say stuff. I mean, it's repellent to every pore of my being. And I've just given up. I don't feel part of this anymore. I feel very alienated. A lot of my generation does, because there's also this other overlay of this, which is these people telling me I have to, me at age 60, I need to get it into vaginas. They're 23 years old.
Better late than never.
My mother.
Oh, Andrew, you'll love them at some point.
Do you understand time, how that used to drive us crazy? You haven't found the right woman? They're telling us this from the fucking high priest position of the LGBTQIA plus movement.
Well, you know,
let us use the term gay anymore. You go find
a lesbian friend.
The basic and you're a gay man. You're a gay man. You can't search for just gay men. If you're a trans man, you can search for other trans men and gay men. Yes.
Is that right?
Wow. That seems to be a coding flaw.
Think about sex and gender is, you know, one, if you include in the, and J.K. Rowling said this, if you include man in the meaning of woman, you've just abolished reality. I mean, if you're doing that, now we were all fine with saying, yes, we're very happy. We understand. You, Loretta, as it were. And we support it and we want it. When one of George W. Bush's classmates at Yale came back to the reunion, he came back as a woman. And Bush greeted him and he said, Mr. President, blah, 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 I'm looking a little different this time. And he said, well, I'm just glad you came as your true self. That's the only dignified, appropriate thing to do in those circumstances.
If anyone saw the last episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, the second to last episode ever of the greatest show of all time, I was wondering if people were going to accuse Larry David of being transphobic, which I looked and took 2 seconds to realize that they had. But there's a moment in it when a woman that he slept with back when he was writing Seinfeld comes back and it's just a man. And he's like, you know, we used to have sex. And he was like, and he gets very uncomfortable. And he's like, no, I didn't. He's like, no, you had sex with me. He's like, no, I didn't. Like, I had sex with a woman. No. And the funny thing is that when you talk about a mother saying to you, or, you know, parents saying to you back in the day that, yeah, you'll get over it. You just need some, you know, time or some instruction or some religion or something. A lesbian friend of mine said something interesting to me. I haven't really thought about it. I don't give these questions too much thought. But she said, you know, what happens to girls that went through what I went through now, like she was butch. She liked like basketball and baseball and she played with the boys and dressed as a boy, is that now people will, you know, the parent will come on, particularly if it's in Brooklyn, and intervene rather than saying you'll get over it, say you might be a man. At 13 years old or 14 years old, not that you're a lesbian. And that to her was like the homophobic part, the kind of, to use the language that is used so often on the left, the erasure of homosexuality is like, you, if you have these feelings, you're probably just a guy, which is like, you know, basically saying you can't possibly be gay, which I thought was an amazing point that I hadn't thought.
This is why we're concerned. This is why I am against this education in kindergarten and elementary schools. Because you're telling little effeminate boys that they're really girls, and they need to make it. And they they think, oh, all my problems will be solved. All these things that I haven't quite figured out yet, but are really contradictory. Oh, that would cure it. I just become a girl. Mm-hmm. They tell them that at age 4. They can pick and they pick which one you can become, a boy or a girl or both or not the other or neither or something else. And this is the stuff they're telling them to be inclusive of trans children. They're telling gay children what we were always told.
I'm fascinated by people who are
not really a man. You're a woman.
Yeah.
We have to fight.
You have to explain to me the...
And this upsets me to have this shit, this homophobic shit shoveled back in my face by people who've done nothing, really, to a generation that lived through fucking AIDS.
I have never looked at you Andrew, and said, that is a woman. It's never... I've never thought you were a woman. Just didn't even, for a minute, it didn't even occur to me that you could be a woman. Like, you're like a muscular, bearded man.
You're narrow-minded, Michael Moynihan. Very narrow man.
No, I don't understand.
But look, when I was a little boy, and I was taken up to Christmas with my grandparents, and my little brother is 4 years younger than me, we were sitting in the room with my grandmother and my mom, and he was bashing a truck against the wall, and I was sitting there doing coloring in a book or something. He looked at my brother and to me and said to my mother, well, at least now you have a real boy. And
how old were
seven,
you?
Maybe? No, maybe eight. Huh. 8 or 9, something like that. That's what we heard all the time. It was deeply wounding to us. And they are now inflicting the wound on us again in the interest of the LGBTQIA plus movement. And it's an unbelievable scandal, and it's morally wrong, and it's homo-fucking-phobic. You don't have to justify being attracted to men to anyone, certainly not to someone who's transgender. Fuck you.
I'm curious, Andrew, if you think, and I'm drawing on my own experience here somewhat, but if you think that essentially for the gay rights movement to have been identified in that specific way, that narrow way. It's the dog.
It's the homophobic dog. Sorry to interrupt, it's important. Camille, sorry. Harry S. or Capote?
Harry S., for fuck's sake.
No.
Who do you think I am? Well,
listen, I don't know.
You know the latest one?
I'm telling me to judge.
Show? That one I just want to fucking anchor.
Oh, God.
Oh, but you get that in DC? Everyone figured out in DC.
In 2023? 2024, that is?
He's not used to seeing out of windows because I live in this loft, which was originally a classroom in the schoolhouse. So the windows were all pierced to such a height that no one sitting down could see out of them. So the kids wouldn't be distracted.
No.
I live in the old music room of the segregated, of what was, of course.
referring to the good old days and then wandered off.
The good old days when kids couldn't look out the window and try to figure out what gender they were.
Yeah, windows that are very high. I mean, it could be good for keeping the kids from getting distracted, also keeping them prisoner.
Yes.
Indefinitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's good for both things. But all right. I was going to ask, Andrew, you had essentially a social justice movement and it was branded as, you know, a gay rights movement. But as a matter of fact, it is essentially a individual liberty campaign. And there's a sense in which all of the aggressive identity politics and the advocacy on behalf of particular groups does seem to lend itself to some of the kind of intense factionalism that we've seen. And I don't know that it would be as effective a way of advocating, but if the centerpiece of all of the advocacy had always been individual dignity, there's nothing unusual about me, there's nothing unusual about our lifestyle, like the appeal here is essentially like that sanitation workers strike in 1968, like the pin just said, I am a man. It's an assertion of human dignity. Do you think if things had always been done that way, and if there hadn't been rather explicit appeal on the basis of, you know, race pride or kind of pride associated with one's sexuality, but individual dignity, that it might have made a difference today, that perhaps we've been would have been somewhat inoculated against some of the extremes that have taken hold now?
I think in most of these movements, there will always be these two strains. And there'll be the, let's emphasize how we are different and oppressed. And let's emphasize how we are, what we have in common with other people, and to be treated as well as other people. And I think that the individual liberty argument, obviously, is not only the right argument, I think it's psychologically a lot healthier. Just think it's psychologically crippling to be constantly thinking about, am I gay, queer, trans? What, this stuff, the whole point was not to do that.
Right.
And the thing is that I lived that, because I know it sounds strange, because there really until my generation, really, not, I mean, since the late 60s, that, again, what happened before was there a really interesting individual liberty. You have people like Bayard Rustin, you had one magazine, you had the Madison Society, you had a whole bunch of people who were, and a whole bunch of gay men that were incredibly important in the conservative movement, whether it be Marvin Liebman, Bob Bauman, Dolan, all those people. But it was only when my lot came along that we just said, no, we are like you. I mean, we want what you have. And we don't want to upset the avocado. And we want, as Bruce Bauer said, we want a place at the table. And Donna Minkowitz, God bless her heart, said, no, we want to throw the table over, revolutionize the world. Those are the two options. But the minute the gay rights movement presented the individual liberty argument and the responsibility argument and the, it won. That's what, this is the, it was the biggest success ever. They just never thought of doing it. Or maybe because, and this I think is probably true, that they didn't believe they were worthy of it. I mean, my question when I was always asked about marriage equality in the 80s and 90s was like, why are you, what is it about you that were interested in this marriage equality? Why, you want to get married? I'm like, I don't really want to get married myself. shouldn't you be asking yourself, how little faith did we have in ourselves that before now we even dared to ask the right to marry? What low level of self-esteem did it take us to feel that we were not worthy of? And a lot of, especially gay politics, left politics, is very defensive, psychologically weak. This stuff is psychologically a protection. It doesn't free you. You're constantly protected by this web of identity-ness that constrains the full range of your possibilities as a human being. Not that you should deny it, but you're human first. And as Michael knows, I mean, I love joking about all this shit. I take it, give it, love it. I love being gay. I fucking love being gay. It's been the most wonderful part of my life. But I think also the thing that happened was that the AIDS epidemic kind of forced us, gay people, to realize, yeah, we are worth it. Yeah, we fucking are. We took care of each other. We stood up. We soldiered through. We fucking survived this thing, and we didn't give up. And we didn't cave to the obvious trope that this is, we deserve this, which was so prevalent in our psyches.
I mean, first of all, I just want to say it's the thing that I love least about you. I just want to make that clear to everybody. I don't even think that I appreciate your homosexuality. But I mean, having sort of faith in... Yeah, I know. Camille, just really, he's Jamaican. Good Lord.
Yeah.
You know what he says about you. He's like, no, I'm not going to talk to Andrew. Marty boy. Marty boy, Sullivan.
I'm going to tell you something about... Anyway, if and when.
No, but
oh boy.
Having the incredible thing about the gay rights movement that is sort of forgotten about, if you look back at the rhetoric, you know, and some of the sort of more extreme rhetoric from certain elements of ACT UP and things like that, is that having sort of faith in yourself to be treated, or having the dignity to be, you know, say we deserve this. The other thing that is forgotten about is that people had no faith in America. And the American people, and said, well, this is just going to be, we have an enormous hill to climb, and there was a hill to climb. But if you look at the opinion polls over such a short period of time, the acceptance of, you know, gay people, then of gay marriage, when you have a very, very moderate interaction on television and the Will and Grace stuff, and then people are like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. I have a gay person in my family. It was very, very fast. And I think that when you go back and you look at the sense that the 80s were overrun by the Jerry Falwells and the sort of Reaganite conservatives who didn't like gay people, et cetera, that you could have been forgiven for thinking this would never happen in America with some of the rhetoric. And it happened pretty fast. I mean, it's a testament to how sort of, you know, open-minded, well, and I don't want to say progressive, but open-minded America was about the whole thing.
Is that gay people are so randomly distributed. Well, we're not like other minorities. If you're Black American, then you will tend to be congregated in certain areas and groups, and you will have intergenerational understandings of yourself, communal understanding of yourself. Every gay generation is born tabula rasa in straight America. So you grow up without not being gay, really. You grow up being around your heterosexual environment. Or if you are gay, you glean it from places and you slowly build it up together. So that makes, as I was talking about today, actually, that makes it not unremarkable that Donald Trump would get almost a third of the gay vote in 2020, 28%. Because how many people randomly distributed across the red states? Do you really expect every gay person in Texas to suddenly be a flaming leftist? No, of course not. Look how many gays, it turns out, were in the military. It was a lot. Bless them.
Mostly the Navy, though, right?
Yeah. Now I know why we lost in Iraq.
Sorry, I'm joking.
If I was in Scotland, I'd be in fucking prison right now for that.
Not before. It'd be a knock on the door any minute now.
No, they're actually the best. They're not the worst, Michael.
But I do think the strange way history works. You talk about the arguments that worked and didn't work. But AIDS was a total black swan event that came in at a particular moment in history and singled out this particular group. And basically, I think there's also an element of being gay, and I'll get slammed for saying this, that you don't have kids, or mostly don't have kids, so do and don't, I mean, I'm not. But mostly, certainly in the past, if you were open to gay, certainly, you can stay immature. You can easily get by without some of the rights of adulthood that straight people have. Or straight. And that means that you can be a little developmentally sort of frozen in a way if you're not.
Sounds amazing.
It's kind of great.
To be honest. I love this.
What am I trying to say here? AIDS going to work us up out of that. It's like, fuck. We're dying. And not only are we dying, but all those people we've been making fun of, we need them to vote for funds to research this. We need them. They are the people taking care of us, actually, in our homes and hospitals. You know, it was a real, let's get real America about something. It was one of those moments where an issue had percolated for a long time, and suddenly this existential thing came across. It transformed everybody's psyches. It portrayed gay men as victims, first and foremost, of a horrible disease. So you'd have to be really callous And what was kind of true was that people weren't overwhelmingly that callous. A few of them were. There was absolutely some, I'm not saying. But I don't think Americans in general, well, put it this way, I don't think they reacted the way that many of my liberal friends thought they would react. And I agree with this. This weird thing, you know, the opposition I had to gay marriage was all from liberals telling me, are you kidding? And the other that that's true about was Barack Obama. I mean, they just looked at every left. I thought he was going to be president the minute I saw him, like 2 years before he ran. And I was like totally stoked. And because I was desperate for post-neocon something. And the universal view among every white liberal was that this country's way too racist. They really do. It's not like they go around saying bigoted things about people. You unearth some of these premises, and it really is. We can't let them run their lives. They're such a bunch of Nazis. I mean, it comes to a very weird thing. And the trouble with the worst thing about the cognitive sort and the red blue divide and all that rest of it is that misunderstanding gets worse and worse. The projections of motives, either way, both ways, are increasingly bizarre and wrong. And this is partly why, you know, Trump is so bad, because he really does stir it all up in us. It makes it all worse for everyone. And I he's not a homophobic person, and I don't think he's going to, they're going to say we're the uniquely anti-LGBT, blah, 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 blah. It's not going to be the case. He's just a kill.
I remember, by the way, and I think Camille and I have talked about this, that the moment it looked like Barack Obama was going to win the presidency, or at least win the nomination, there was a lot of conversation. Well, he's not actually black. I mean, he's not very black. And that's why, and it reminded me a lot of Mrs. Thatcher when she died. And it was like, well, you know, we do have to acknowledge she was one of the first female leaders of this kind of stature. And it's like, well, actually, she wasn't really a woman. and I'm not kidding. You can go find people who say this. She didn't actually, she betrayed women. So she wasn't necessarily a woman. And I love that vision of identity, that somebody randomly gets to assign who is, you know, black, gay, a woman.
Polly Toynbee wrote that as a cover story for the New Statesman while Thatcher was alive in office. This is not our woman prime minister. And of course, that didn't help by never appointing another woman to her cabinet in 11 years, which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
She was a woman. She knew women. So she understood that was probably a risk. A very, very big risk.
Amazing. People on the right, no one talks about the fact that Rishi Sunak is prime minister. That seems to be a pretty fucking big deal to me, actually. No one gets Does he have any? Read a single article where people really celebrate that they would in the way they do in identity politics in America? They just don't.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, we've kept you for a while.
No, I've been blabbering on. I'm sorry. I should have said that.
you have nothing to apologize for.
Never.
It is always a pleasure to have you with us, to spend some time with you, even if you won't remember this tomorrow.
No idea.
I listen to this every week. Yeah. You're my favorite podcast. Yeah. And I was listening to you on the Batty Boys and stuff.
Oh, you listen? Because I was going to say, thank you for coming on Pod Save America and see if you reacted. America's best podcast.
Yes. Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming, Walter. Andrew. And, we appreciate it.
And we'll do it in person.
Yes,
in
person soon. Plug myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's going great, right?
It's absolutely it's great. Dream. It's a dream. Also, please, my book, which Out on a Limb, is the collection of all my essays over the years, which is.
That's a couple of years old now, a year and a half, 2 years old. I bought it. And by the way, I like to point this out to people who are friends when I could very easily get a review copy, but I actually purchased it. So I want credit for that.
It matters, Michael.
Anyway.
What?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, yeah, bye.
We know of new methods of attack. The Trojan horse, the fifth column.